The Bush policies were wrapped into a single legislative bill. It could be the U.S.-China Dependency Act. The excessive tax cuts for the rich, combined with a total...
It's the rock in the building. Khalid. Something up, right, man? Pharrell in the house. Yes. Live from United States, Brooklyn, New York, it's your boy. Young. The nephews is in the house. As soon as the beat drop, we got the streets locked overseas. A Punjabi MC in the rock. I came to see the mommies in the spot. On the count of three, drop your body like it's hot. One, young, two, you, one. Two, three, young hoser, snake charmer. Move your body like a snake, mama. Make me wanna put the snake on ya. I'm on my eighth summer, still hot. Young's the eighth wonder. All I do is get bread, yeah, I take wonder. I take one of your chicks straight from under your armpit. The black Brad Pitt, I'm act till 6 in the a.m. All day I'm P-I-M-P. I am simply attached to the track like Simply. It's simply good, young ho, infinitely hood. O.C. and you don't stop. R.O.C. and we don't stop. Punjabi MC and we don't stop. It's your boy Jay-Z and we don't stop. Nigga R.O.C. and we won't stop. I ain't gotta tell you, but it's your boy Ho from the U.S. You just lay down slow. Catch your boy mingling, England, meddling in the Netherlands. Checking in daily under aliases. We rebellious, we back home. Screaming leave Iraq alone. But all my soldiers in the field, I will wish you safe return. But only love kills war, when will they learn? This international Ho, been having a flow. Before Bin Laden got Manhattan to blow. Before Ronald Reagan got Manhattan to blow. Before I was cabinet there back and forth. Bro, we had it all day. Poppy in the hallway. Cop one on consignment to give you more yay. Yeah, but that's another story. But for now, I'ma turn it around and let the boy play. J, it's your boy Jay-Z and we don't stop. Nigga R.O.C. and we won't stop. Yes. Bounce.
Kill, kill.
Bounce.
Kill, kill.
Bounce.
Kill.
Yes.
Radio. Okay, sorry I'm coming in late, you guys. Couldn't get the mic working here. And let's see, in the background, you were listening to Punjab MC. Okay, what we're going to do, we're going to go back into a little Punjab MC. And if I can get him going here, And but in a few minutes, we're going to come up on Dr. Cornel West. Here on the Friday News, Kill Radio Friday News, 6 p.m. And this is a recording I did with Dr. West a little bit before the election of 2004 here in Los Angeles. He was visiting on a lecture tour. I was privileged to meet him. So let's go back into Jay-Z and Punjab MC, and then we're going to segue into a little, sorry, the mic's, Q Radio is engineer free here, you guys. And then we're going to go into Dr. West. So let's go back into Punjab MC.
Make me want to put the snake on ya. I'm on my eighth summer. Still hot, young's the eighth wonder. All I do is get bread, yeah, I take wonder. I take one of your chicks straight from under your armpit. The black Brad Pitt. I'm at till 6 in the a.m. All day I'm P-I-M-P. I am simply attached to the track like Simply. It's simply good. Young hope, infinitely hood.
What was going on in this country? You know, in this country was first discovered, you know, the patriots and everything. And it's like, if someone brings that up, they're told to shut up if they bring it up in front of the president. I mean, it's like, the patriots in this country were doing the exact same thing that the insurgents are doing in Iraq right now. I mean, do you have any comment on that? And how come that's never brought up? I mean...
Yeah, I think the analogy is a difficult one for the administration, because the administration recognizes that anti-imperialist struggle is legitimate. And it's legitimate in part because there would be no USA without an anti-imperialist struggle against the British Empire. And so the kind of resistance that one has certainly seen in Iraq is against a particular occupation of an empire, namely the American Empire in this sense. It's an imperfect analogy, as you can imagine, because you've also got a situation of indigenous peoples in the United States. You've got slaves in the United States. And then you've got anti-imperial, violent guerrilla fighters like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, who were quite heroically resisting British imperialism. In Iraq, you've got resistance to American imperialism, but the slavery, indigenous peoples, and so forth, it's not there, so you've got some imperfect analogy there, but I think the analogy is a useful one, and Bush administration will certainly not touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah, you're the first person who I've ever actually heard bring up that point. That, I mean, George Washington, there were rumors that before the war even started, he was like, him and bands of like his men would go around assassinating British soldiers as they slept, and King George did have a bounty on his head.
Absolutely. I mean, these are serious guerrilla fighters, though, man.
I'm sure that King George was telling people in England the exact same thing that King George is telling people here now in this country. I just thought of the two names.
No, it's true. I mean, one of the things to keep in mind is that the army of the American Empire is disproportionately working class, disproportionately poor, disproportionately black and brown. Whereas George Washington was an elite slaveholder, and his army consisted of a variety of different kinds of people in the United States at that time. And of course, Yorktown, his army was 26% black.
I know that. Oh, yes, it's very important.
That was one of the reasons why he freed his slaves when he died, because he had to wrestle with the humanity of black people, because he saw black men heroically resisting along with himself. In fact, you may have noticed some of the paintings that you have of George Washington in the boat has black soldiers in it.
Prince Whipple.
Because they had to acknowledge, you know, it was 27% black. And that's something even Thomas Jefferson didn't do when he died, was free of slaves, you see, because George Washington was wrestling with this. But George Washington was an elite slaveholder who recognized that he, along with his other elite friends, had to go fight. Now, one of the positive things about Brother Michael Moore's film is here you have one young person out of all the 435 congressmen and women, their sons and daughters, only one serving in the war. You go into any brown community, any black community, any white working class community, and you ask them, how many of you have relatives who are in the armed forces? 40%, 50%. 60%. You say, what the hell is going on? Something's wrong here. Mm-hmm. Same is true at my own place where I teach at Princeton. You know, you've got students all fired up. They pro-war. They ready to defend Bush. None of them want to join the army. They don't want to fight the war. So they can get all fired up and be pro-war in their rhetoric and then want to send working class cousins and friends to fight the darn thing, you see. And so you say, well, what's going on here? Well, this is another level of the class hypocrisy that's operating.
Yesterday it came out, I was looking at an online newsletter in Palestine where Sharon told his soldiers to start shooting young Palestinian men in the Golan. I mean, I had to bow my head when I heard that. It's genocide. How is the United Nations going to let Sharon get away with that? I mean, they're basically trying to stop a whole generation of Palestinian kids. I guess they figure that's the only way to stop these bombings. I heard that he gave orders for his soldiers to shoot young Palestinian men.
In the ground. Well, I mean, the thing is, so many of the Israeli armed forces have been shooting them in the back and the heart, which is killing them. It's murdering them anyway.
But
so that the groan is symbolic in terms of a certain kind of attempt to attack their manliness, attack their masculinity, and so forth. But the situation, as you know, has been out of control for a while. That you basically have a Bush administration that has green-lighted Sharon's authoritarian policies and his colonial policies in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And right now, as you know, there's a debate in Israel about Sharon's withdrawing from Gaza Strip. What the press doesn't accent is how he's permanently strangleholding the West Bank. So that the whole issue of occupying a people and the whole issue of subjugating a people is being concealed in light of his symbolic withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, with his own right wing upset with him for attempting to even do that, you see. So it's a problem of the press not being honest enough and candid enough to tell the world the truth about the Palestinian suffering there. Now, see, I am deeply committed to the security of Israeli brothers and sisters. I recognize that Jewish brothers and sisters are a hated people for 2,000 years in the West, especially in a Christian and Muslim-dominated West. They had to jump out of the burning buildings of Europe. But we have to recognize they landed on the backs of Arabs, you see. In some ways, like the Puritans who were persecuted and fled Britain and ended up on indigenous people's land. So you can't lose sight of the suffering of the Arab brothers and sisters who had nothing to do with the hatred, the murder, the systematic, attempted systematically annihilate Jews in Europe. So you end up with the Arab brothers and sisters having to bear this cost, and then Israel, by 1948, slowly connecting to the American Empire during the Cold War, more and more rendering black suffering, Palestinian suffering, invisible. As if a Palestinian life doesn't have the same value as a Jewish life or Israeli life in general, you see. And this has been part of the problem. I think this is one of the reasons why you had Islamic terrorism.
Well, you sound like you agree with me on one point. I mean, I have Israeli friends. I think that's a beautiful country. My problem is with that government, particularly.
Well, it's just a question of justice.
Yeah.
It's a question of justice.
I mean, I literally put Sharon up there.
Well, Sharon's a war criminal. I mean, everybody, we know that from way back in the 1950s.
Yeah.
Could I jump in?
Sure.
Do you mind?
Sure.
I don't mean to put you on the spot about this, but it's really quick. If people ask me this question, Dr. West, bring it more home. How come people like Loretta Scott King isn't coming out to push Kerry? I mean, this is the most important. Now, I don't mean that. I know you don't have the direct.
That's a very good question. Part of it is that Kerry hasn't really spoken with any power and vision. I think that I can't speak for Coretta, but part of the problem with Kerry is we know he's coming out of a milquetoast Democratic Party that's been deferential to right-wing rhetoric, trying to triangulate the Republican Party policies and so forth. Dean injected some serious energy into the party. Kerry came to life for a moment, and he's yet to find his voice. So I think he's got to be much more strident and strong for somebody like Coretta. I mean, she's married to Martin. You know, she ain't married no milquetoast Negro. She's married to a free black man who spoke the truth about America. And my hunch is that if Kerry finds his voice, he had it in 71, looked like he had it a few months in Iowa. I don't know what's happened since then.
Yes, sir.
See, you know what I mean? He's so, I don't know what the right word is, though, but he just hasn't come out strongly. He's got to speak from his soul. Now, whether Coretta would come out after he spoke from his soul is still an open question, because I can't speak for Coretta, you know.
Okay, I'm empty.
Yeah, you're ready. We're talking about that European question and about the Palestinians. Okay, so like,
yes.
To me, one thing in reading your work and thinking about black culture in America, here you had M.A. Césaire in 1950 saying straight up, Europe is indefensible. But somehow the Jewish question has reinvented that indefensibility. In the face of that, right, we've reinvented it using America. Britain and Germany, even real Germany, have used America to maintain that thing, which in 50, 51, 52, and the civil rights movement obviously was a major thing here in America, but
right.
The academics and intellectuals had said, hey, it's got to end, you know. Your whole so-called Enlightenment period is a period of oppression for most of the world. Now, we have 50 years of them oppressing country after country after country, military escalation to the point of $417 billion. What are we going to do? I mean, intellectually, that space we finally had, Camus, Orwell, Césaire, M.A., others,
ooh,
in the 50,
yeah.
middle of the century
yeah,
before
yeah.
all this, we had it for a second. We had them looking at it like that. Now it's another thing. Is that, I don't know if that's too broad a way to put it, but maybe you could weigh in on how to deal with this in the 21st century.
Well, I mean, in some ways it's like, like after the Congress of Vienna in 1815, where you had thick waves of counter-revolution, thick waves of conservative politics, and the emergence of reactionary elites and nation-states. And since the 1980s, we have had thick waves of conservatism, thick waves of reactionary elites, Thatcher, Reagan, you can go right across the board. And so Aimé Césaire was writing at a moment in which the age of Europe was over, right? It's 1945. Europe is devastated, it's divided, and it's dependent on the American Empire and the Soviet Empire. It can't make it on its own.
But is the Jewish question attached? That's what I'm at, in
well,
a way.
The Jewish question emerged,
you know,
right
in a way,
after
right?
the end of Europe. But it is still one of the outposts, because you can't talk really about Israel without talking about British imperialism earlier.
And the mandate.
And the white paper, the mandate, and so forth. And the fact that both the Soviet Union and the United States do converge on allowing for this particular haven for these peoples who have been so, you know, viciously treated by Europe and Russia and others. But as the Cold War heats up, and new imperial realities emerge with tremendous power, it's clear that Israel is siding with the American Empire, and the American Empire tends to disproportionately engage in counter-revolution against decolonizing anti-imperial struggles in Africa. I mean, we got to remind the U.S. government, Nelson Mandela was on the terrorist list of the U.S. government for 25 years.
Yep.
They were just happy that when he emerged, he didn't treat the people who had treated him the way he was treated. And that's part of the rich tradition of being committed to democracy as a progressive, as a revolutionary, that the aim is not to demonize the other, trash the other, or kill their children and loved ones. It's to build a society in which all human beings can live with dignity. And people were surprised. Now Mandela, my God. Gandhi was the same way. King was the same way. We can go right across the board. Latin America has its whole host of persons the same way, you see. But you see, we're dealing right now with 30 or 35 years of an ice age. And by ice age, I mean deeply conservative and reactionary elites shaping the world in their own image. So that we've lost sight of C.L.R. James's and the Aimé Césaires and the Paul Robesons and the W.B. Du Boises and the Singh brothers in India. We can go on and on and on. That's a rich legacy that more and more is far-fetched because 50 years have intervened, in which, for the most part, the American Empire has triumphed. Now, the Soviet Empire went under in 1991. It was repressive. It was regimenting, and it was deeply anti-Semitic, too. It couldn't deal, right? Even though it actually made some very important contributions to anti-colonial struggles in its own context.
Right, right.
It hadn't taken seriously the lives of its own ordinary people and protected their rights and liberties.
This is our responsibility, though. So academics and intellectuals here have to rope it down, right?
We have to rope it down, and we've got to reconnect. We are the Aimé Césaires and C.L.R. Jameses and others who are truth-tellers and whose insights still challenge us in 2004.
Dr. West, you mentioned one of my heroes, Paul Robeson. I actually wrote a play about him.
Is that right?
Yeah, I wrote a play.
I'll
tell you about it one day. It was a fictional piece about what happened if he met Stephen Fetcher. It was an interesting piece.
Right?
Yeah. But Dr. West,
you see how the FBI, CIA tried to
Oh, yeah.
Kill his spirit.
Well, that's
murder
my point.
His soul.
Sir, why in this country, whenever a black intellectual, and I'm talking about like Spike Lee, who, mm-hmm. I'm not that much a fan of Spike's art, but I love his politics.
Well, Spike got a good spirit of resistance.
Well, how come in this country, whenever a black man who's intellectual speaks mm-hmm. above a whisper, he's called a racist? You know, Spike Lee is not a racist.
Oh,
he's
no.
not a racist.
Spike not a racist at all.
But I'm sure, and maybe you even get it sometime. Whenever an educated black man with some letters speaks above a whisper, he's called a racist.
Well, see, a racist oftentimes in America is defined as somebody who is deeply concerned about peoples of color suffering. And if you make black suffering, brown suffering, red suffering, yellow mm-hmm. suffering a major point of reference, they think you are obsessed with race. And whoever
good
is
point.
Obsessed
good
with
point.
Race
good
becomes
point.
A racist. You
good
see,
point.
So instead of the Klan and a whole host of other folk who we know are racist because they actually lynch black folk and tell the world they're proud of it, right? Or instead of racist, those who promote racist policies, right? Knowing that black schools and white schools receiving differential kind of treatment and so forth, it's the people who are concerned about people suffering who end up being called racist. But I mean, in some ways, that's a compliment, because there's nothing wrong with being concerned with the suffering of people, whoever they are. But in the United States, it is disproportionately percentage-wise people of color. Now, I'm concerned about white suffering too, but it's a moral question.
Mm-hmm.
Ralph Paul Robeson was a giant precisely because he constituted a formidable threat to the American establishment because of his courage of telling the truth about the depths of a vicious legacy of white supremacy. Any black man who does that, he is going to be targeted, is going to be harassed, and may be murdered, because the threat is real.
Well, just like Gene Genet say they couldn't sing about Paul Robeson, they couldn't deal with the black red person.
Well, it was
the American
both.
Government.
It was, but Robeson's red was always subordinate to his concern about sufferings of oppressed. That's why he never joined the Communist Party.
Mm.
He knew that the Communist Party had limitations and had shortcomings, but he also knew that they were a major force in terms of raising the issue of white supremacy. You see what I mean? So that in that sense, I mean, the black red is just a way of painting him communist in order to trivialize his message and to somehow devalue his witness. Martin Luther King Jr. went through the South between 1955 and 1962, all through the South. Picture Martin Luther King Jr. as a communist.
I heard about that. I heard about
that. His brother, the Christian minister, King Stanley, Soviet Union. One of his heroes was Norman Thomas, who was his head of the Socialist Party, right? They still call him a communist. Why? Once they paint you with that brush, they don't have to take you seriously, and it becomes open season on you.
Can I follow up on your question about
Coretta
Scott King?
Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
This question about Coretta Scott King coming out brings up a question. I got people around me who say, oh, well, you know what? These are two pro-war candidates. This is the white man's election again. And turnout is a major problem to how democracy is done in America.
Yeah.
What would you say in this instance? I got somebody, you know, in the office saying, look, whatever, it's the white man's election again, because they see Kerry and Bush up there. How would you respond?
Well, I would say that you should never, ever view white brothers and sisters, the white community, or the white man in a monolithic way, you see.
But you see the difference between
JFK is not the same as Goldwater.
Mm.
JFK got deep problems. He's pro-imperialist. He wants to go in Vietnam and so forth and so on. He's lagging on the civil rights issue. But he's not Goldwater. And I think most folk have to reach the point of mature judgment to see that there are differences in the white community. There's differences in white politicians. So even though they might be functioning under a very limited framework, which I believe they are, because it's true, Kerry is pro-imperialist. Kerry doesn't speak the truth.
Mm.
We live in a political system, and we'll talk about this tonight. It is characterized in part by legalized bribery, normalized corruption, and institutionalized graft. Everybody know that. But Kerry won't tell the people that, because he's part of that system. You see? So that when people look at this, get outside and say, well, generally speaking, they're just part of the same system. They're all the same. Just white folk doing so and so and so. You say, well, you know, you got to get a little closer in your analysis. You see? Because it's true that Kerry's got tremendous problems. He's not the same as Bush. Bush is very dangerous. Kerry is milquetoast, that he provides wiggle room for working people, poor people.
Yeah.
He's not going to allow a Supreme Court to become the instrument of the right wing. He's not going to allow a trade union movement to be crushed. He's not going to support it that much, but he's not going to allow it to be crushed. He's concerned about the sweatshops. He's talked about that. Is he going to fundamentally change it? No, because he's not a progressive in the way that some of us are. He is a neoliberal. You see what I mean? So that you have to say to people very honestly, you're absolutely right that the system's not going to fundamentally change. You're absolutely right. They're not going to deal with poverty, criminal justice system, prison industrial complex in a way that they should. But that doesn't mean they're the same. And
Dr.
we have to make that point very strongly.
We got to end this. We got to see, because I want you to be ready. Get rested
well,
up.
I'm always ready.
But for the IMC, Kill Radio, and KPFK, sir, we really thank you.
Thank you so very much. You all keep up the wonderful dialogue
real
and the reflection you're doing, though.
Real honor.
Very much so. Very much so. I appreciate it, though, y'all.
Come back through to our station anytime, you know. You got an open door at KPFK. When they come hunting you, especially in case this guy wins, you know, you got an open door over here.
And we got a struggle. Based on either one.
Yeah. No, November 3rd, right? 4th, 5th, it's all, that's what we've been talking about on the air lately. November 3rd, 4th, 5th, doesn't matter, you know?
Absolutely.
A real honor, I tell you, a real honor.
This is too good.
Hassan, yeah.
Well, the first thing I want to say is, mandate my ass. Because it seems as though we've been convinced that 26% of the registered voters, not even 26% of the American people, but 26% of the registered voters form a mandate or a landslide. 21% voted for Skippy and 3-4% voted for somebody else who might have been running. But oh yeah, I remember in this year that we have now declared the year from Shogun to Reagan, I remember what I said about Reagan. Minute. Acted like an actor. Hollywood. Acted like a liberal, acted like General Franco when he acted like governor of California, then he acted like a Republican, then he acted like somebody was going to vote for him for president. And now we act like 26% of the registered voters is actually a mandate. We're all actors in this, I suppose. What has happened is that in the last 20 years, America has changed from a producer to a consumer. And all consumers know that when the producer names the tune, the consumer has got to dance. That's the way it is. We used to be a producer, very inflexible at that, and now we are consumers and finding it difficult to understand. Natural resources and minerals will change your world. The Arabs used to be in the third world. They have bought the second world and put a firm down payment on the first one. Controlling your resources will control your world. This country has been surprised by the way the world looks now. They don't know if they want to be Matt Dillon or Bob Dylan. They don't know if they want to be diplomats or continue the same policy of nuclear nightmare diplomacy. John Foster Dulles ain't nothing but the name of an airport now. The idea concerns the fact that this country wants nostalgia. They want to go back as far as they can, even if it's only as far as last week. Not to face now or tomorrow, but to face backwards. And yesterday was the day of our cinema heroes riding to the rescue at the last possible moment. The day of the man in the white hat or the man on the white horse. Or the man who always came to save America at the last moment. Someone always came to save America at the last moment. Especially in B-movies. And when America found itself having a hard time facing the future, they looked for people like John Wayne. But since John Wayne was no longer available, they settled for Ronald Reagan. And it has placed us in a situation that we can only look at like a B-movie. Come with us back to those inglorious days when heroes weren't zeros, before fair was square, when the cavalry came straight away and all American men were like Hemingway to the days of the wondrous B-movie. The producer, underwritten by all the millionaires necessary, will be Casper the Defensive Weinberger. No more animated choice is available. The director will be Attila the Hague, running around frantically declaring himself in control and in charge. The ultimate realization of the inmates taking over at the asylum. The screenplay will be adapted from the book called Voodoo Economics by George Papadoc Bush. music by the village people, the very military macho man. A theme song for saber rattling and selling wars door to door. Remember, we're looking for the closest thing we can find to John Wayne. Cliches abound like kangaroos, courtesy of some spaced out Marlon Perkins, a Ray Gun contemporary. Cliches like itchy trigger finger and tall in the saddle and riding off or on into the sunset. Cliches like get off of my planet by sundown. More so than cliches like he died with his boots on. Marine tough to man is, Bogart tough to man is, Cagney tough to man is, Hollywood tough to man is, Cheapsteak tough, and Bonzo substantial.
Kill Radio, everybody out there. Again, this is Kill Radio. Engineer free Kill Radio. Okay, and you're listening to Gil Scott Heron in the background. And this is the 6 p.m. Friday Kill Radio News. And this title of this tune in the background is called B-Movies by Gil Scott Heron. And before that, we were listening to Dr. Cornel West. Recorded a little bit before the presidential election last year. He was kind enough to grace us with an interview before he went on stage. And there's a couple of people I want to thank for that. Skylight Books, first of all, they brought him into town here. Skylight Books on North Vermont here in Los Angeles. I want to thank Princeton University for loaning us Dr. West. And Dr. West's agents at Penguin Books in New York, who helped me hook up the interview. And last but not least, KPFK and M.T. Carthage, news director M.T. Carthage, who that was also who you heard talking to Dr. West. So thank all those people. I want to thank all those people. And again, this is Hassan here, Kill Radio, 6 p.m. news, Friday. Let's go back into Gil Scott Heron, and then we're going to go into some phone calls about the Devin Brown shooting here in Los Angeles by the 13-year-old African-American youth that was shot by, was murdered by a Los Angeles police officer.
Lon Chaney, our man of a thousand faces. No match for Ron. Doug Henning does the makeup. Special effects from Grecian Formula 16 and Crazy Glue. Transportation furnished by the David Rockefeller Remote Control Company. Their slogan is, why wait for 1984? You can panic now and avoid the rush. So much for the good news. As Wall Street goes, so goes the nation. And here's a look at the closing numbers.
You posed a question at the beginning of the program, and you asked, what does the shooting say about the state of community relations and the LAPD? And I think that over the past couple of years, it's sort of deteriorated. And I'll give you an example. I'm part of a pretty big block club, and we started inviting the police to our Saturday meetings, and when they started to come, everything was hunky-dory. But then when the community was very blunt and honest about what they perceived as a violent approach that the police took with a variety of issues, the police stopped coming because they felt like they were being attacked. And everyone, just about a week ago when we met, we were talking about how this is an unfortunate change of events, because we felt like we were getting somewhere, voicing our opinion, but when that started to happen, we were seen as hostile community members, and I think that the shooting is just the climax or the pinnacle of this growing trend in the LAPD, where there is violence, especially, and I have to say this, with underrepresented peoples.
Alex, give me, we're going to speak with Chief Bratton next week. Give me the name, if you don't mind sharing this, or actually I'll put you on hold and we'll get it off the air, and we will talk to Chief Bratton specifically about officers who were coming and not coming now. So perhaps we can help facilitate that side of it. And let me ask Dr. Schwabe, any ideas about if they actually do get the police officers back in the room, how you can continue this dialogue? Because certainly people do have a lot of complaints and want to be able to voice those. Is there a better way to do this?
Sure. Alex, when we do these days of dialogue, either on a large scale or a small scale, we always have a neutral facilitator. And these facilitators are volunteers who've been trained by the LA City Attorney's Office, their dispute resolution program. It's important sometime if you have a confrontational issue to have a neutral facilitator. For one thing, in the case that you were mentioning, if people are becoming too violent, if you will, through their speech, or if they're really not giving the police officer a chance for a sort of an even level playing field, a facilitator can help with that.
But aren't cops supposed to be able to take this? I mean, to be very
sure, they are. Sure, just as all of us are.
Yeah.
But we're all human, and I've seen huge differences among police officers in dialogues involving police and the community, and some can do just a splendid job, and others, well, that's not their job or not the way they see their job.
But, Alex, I think you bring up a good point that there does seem to be that this breakdown in communication seems to, at least from what you've seen on the street, that this does seem to be prevalent. I tell you what, we'll pass the information on to the chief, so hang on. Let me go out to the 405 freeway. Paul wants to weigh in on a different side of the issue. Hi, Paul.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Well, I don't believe that an officer truly goes to work in the morning thinking, who can I shoot today? I really have problems wondering why a parent lets a 13-year-old out in the middle of the night, and I really believe that the officer's out there trying to do the best for the city, working their best for the city, and he felt a threat to himself.
So you saw this purely as a police reaction to what appeared to be a real threat then?
Yeah, I think he saw a threat to himself. I don't think he was thinking, oh, I can get this guy because he's acting out of line. He was in fear for his own life, to protect himself. He has to protect himself first before he can protect the rest of us.
Paul, thanks very much. I appreciate that call. 866-893-5722 is our phone number. Your thoughts on Paul's call? Jim's with us in Los Angeles. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, how you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Yeah, I'm calling. I'm a black man myself living in L.A., and I understand the outrage of a young man getting shot. But just like your previous caller said, people have to keep in mind that this young man was out in apparently a stolen car in the middle of the night. You know, if he wasn't doing something that was illegal, then he wouldn't have put himself in this position. So as horrible as it is, putting yourself in that position is the problem. If you're at home in bed where you should be, you wouldn't have that problem.
Now, I'll answer back with a couple of things that I've heard in response in the last couple of weeks. One is his mom was working two jobs. His father had recently died, so she was under a lot of pressure, and apparently the supervision was not what it should have been. How do you react to that kind of an answer?
Well, you know, that's understandable, and that is a difficult circumstance. Still, being out at that time of night shouldn't be acceptable for anybody at that age. You know, I understand it's difficult, and they've got working two jobs, and you know, the shock of having your father die suddenly is something I had to deal with as a youngster as well. But you don't go out at 4 o'clock at night in a stolen car. Even if he was 16 and driving his own car, that'd be different. But at his age, doing what he was doing, that should not have been the case.
All right, Jim, thanks very much for the call. 866-893-5722. David now joins us from Simi Valley. Hi, David.
Hi, I don't want to mimic what the other gentlemen have said, especially the one from South Central. I'm very proud of him. I mean, I thought he was going to say something different. Anyhow, I just wanted to add this, that it's not so much that there was a lack of supervision. Of course, they're working mothers. You can't expect that. It's the values that are instilled. Now, he had his father for a number of years, and the mother was there. And I don't only blame them. I blame their local community of putting up as the role model criminals very often instead of good people. And there are plenty, millions of good black people, if he was black, I think he was, that should have been the role model, not criminals. And he was the criminal, and the parents and the community should have guided him better.
All right, David, thank you. I appreciate that call. 866-893-5722. Dr. William Schwabe is with us from Days of Dialogue. Actually, one thing that David said that wasn't necessarily on point, but I found kind of interesting, he said he was surprised about the point of view expressed by someone from South Central. Do we come into these kinds of conversations with preconceived notions?
We sure do, and I was also made note of that comment, David, that you made, that you were glad to see that someone from South Central or South Los Angeles had the view that was expressed by Jim earlier. And when you come to these dialogues, if you have a mixed group, sometimes it's really an eye-opening experience because you go in with certain expectations, and then you find that here's this person across the table from you that you can really respect.
866-893-5722. We got a comment off the air. Someone asked, why does everyone think that the police officer knew it was a 13-year-old at the wheel? And I suppose the other side of that question is, did a police officer have to shoot his gun 10 times to stop the vehicle? Those are questions certainly to be answered. What do you think? 866-893-5722. Marvin is with us from West Hollywood. Hello, Marvin.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thank you. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me. One thing I wonder is, you know, everybody makes it sound like, you know, this guy was shot while he was trying to parallel park or something. And from what I understand, he was traveling at quite a high velocity of speed when he smashed into the police car.
Although I think when they went back and looked at it, they didn't find skid marks to find that speed was a factor. Or at least that's a question at this point in time. But you see that he was using the car as a weapon.
Right. Right, and you know, I think that it's kind of like the previous caller said. It's, you know, you don't know who is at the helm of that ship, and when somebody's trying to run you over, you know, it's kind of, you know, police have to make those split decisions all the time, and you know, it's you know, I mean, I don't know what I would do if somebody's trying to run me over.
All right, Marvin, I appreciate that input. 866-893-5722. Joyce is in Seal Beach. Hi, Joyce.
Well, I'm astonished. I thought I might be the lone dissenter, but I agree with all these people. I raised 4 kids alone, working 3 jobs after I was divorced, and it's the values that you instill in the home that would prevent kids from doing that. It's not easy to raise kids, and I did have problems with some of them, but, you know, if one of them had gone out and done that, I would have had to accept the fact that they chose that behavior against all the teachings that I had given them, and they'd gone out and done it. And I wouldn't be blaming the community, and I would not be blaming the police. I would take responsibility as a parent.
All right, Joyce is offering up the thought that this is a matter of responsibility. The kid was doing something wrong, and what happened thereafter was a result of his actions. What do you think? 866-893-5722. This is our special Talk of the City program, a day of dialogue, if you will, opening the phones to hear what you think about the shooting of Devin Brown. More conversation with you and with Dr. William Schwabe in a moment, right here on 89.3. Open the phones to talk about the shooting of Devin Brown. This weekend, you can participate in a day of dialogue, an opportunity to sit down and talk about issues that matter all over Southern California. We'll give you information about that in a bit. I'm joined by the Executive Director of Days of Dialogue, Dr. William Schwabe, and we are taking your calls right now for an audio version of it. 866-893-5722. Michael's with us from Huntington Beach. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Katie. Hi, Dr. Schwabe. How you doing?
Fine, thanks. Hi. What's on
Good.
Your mind?
I just want to call and point on a comment on the last caller that mentioned about speed. The
again,
driver,
this is
Devin Brown,
Q Radio.
Steps,
Q,
the,
and we're too low here. We're too low.
The police through in the city of Los
Let me
Angeles.
See.
But I have family.
Q Radio. QRadio.org.
You know,
again, this is Engineer Free. QRadio.org. Thank you, James Maverick, for being my engineer
over.
Today.
And
we were listening to in the background some we were listening to some call-ins on the Devin Brown situation. So I have our new news anchor from Monday, James Maverick, here in the studio. He also does the Sunday morning show, and he's going to tell us what he feels about what he's hearing in these phone calls.
Is this on? Can you hear me?
Give me... No, we're not on.
Okay.
I hear you now really
there.
Good.
Okay, good. There's only 3 words that I can have to rebut any argument that anyone makes about the kid being responsible for his actions, and that's 13 years old. The kid was 13 years old. He was a kid. He was just coming into puberty. I have listened to these people saying that the child should have been responsible for his actions, and that argument is false or flawed because they're trying to assign adult responsibilities on a 13-year-old child. It's flawed in that respect. I mean, you know, you don't have kids who truly know right from wrong. They're still maturing. and they're feeling their oats. And the thing is that joyriding is pretty much a rite of passage.
Exactly.
And it's you know, kids are going to get into trouble. It's part of the way they explore their limits. Sometimes, you know, some kids will lie to their parents. Some kids will try drugs or alcohol at that age. And some kids kill themselves with such experimentation. This kid was driving a car.
And
evidently not very well.
And something my dad used to always say to me and my sister before he took us out to get our driving test at 16, he would say, and I can remember hearing him saying this to my sister, then saying it to me, remember, a car can be a weapon. Mm-hmm. You know. But James, let me add two or three things really quick that I've been telling a lot of people since this happened, and I'm usually alone in my views, but, you know, the whole city, well, half of the city is saying this is a racial incident. I think, like I told you before, I do not think it is. I really don't. I think certain people on both sides of the fence are trying to make it a racial issue. I do not think it is. What I do think, some questions I would like to know is, would this cop have fired his gun 13 times into that car if this car had been in Beverly Hills or Encino, California? For our international audience, Encino is another area in outside of Los Angeles that's really high maintenance, like Beverly Hills.
This kid would not have, this police officer would not have fired his gun if it was in Beverly Hills.
In Beverly Hills.
He would not have fired his gun if it was in Pacific Palisades. He would not have fired his gun if it was in Malibu.
He didn't just fire his gun.
He would not have fired his gun wildly.
He emptied that gun 13 times.
Wildly if it was in Palos Verdes.
Right.
I disagree. I believe it is a racial incident, and for reasons that I think have gone unobserved. I believe that because the police do not vest themselves within that community, they are not seen as guardians of the community. They are seen more as an occupying force, and there is an undercurrent of animosity. There's a siege mentality, and it is racially motivated. That officer should never have been in that department at all.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say in that community. I see another show here, because I see we kind of differ on points of view. Maybe I can come on your new show and add a rebuttal. But let me say something else really quick, something that's turning my stomach, and I'm hearing it in the black and white community, and unfortunately, I'm kind of hearing it more in the black community, and it's disgusting me that people are saying, where was this woman? Why was her son out on the street at 3 a.m. with a 13-year-old boy? And, you know, people, I'm so tired of hearing that, and I want to say this right now. The woman was in bed because she had two jobs. You know, at least people can't say she was a crack whore or something.
Well, I don't know what black community you've been listening to, but it hasn't been up in my black community. Everybody in the communities that I'm aware of know that this woman was working two jobs. They know that this boy's father was killed. They know that...
I think the boy's father had a heart attack. To be
died.
Yeah,
well, he died.
Natural cause.
You know, his father was taken from him.
Right.
You know, and it was right at the time where a boy needs the stabilizing influence of that primary male relationship. There were a lot of things that went wrong there. I mean, what's the other alternative? To be the typical suburban mother who's on crystal meth because they need the energy to catch up with their kid?
James, we got to slash this. Tell everybody about the new show you're doing, what you're doing Sunday morning, because I want to go into a little Mumia Jamal and then James Brown.
Okay, real quick, plug on my show, 622 Soul Street. I am DJ Shango, and I play gospel, hip-hop, and R&B music, classic and contemporary. Also, you can find me on the Kill Radio News Monday evenings from 6 to 7, preceding the program Get the Fuck Up.
James, thanks again for coming in and sitting in and lending a little bit of your knowledge of this incident, because I know you're one of my few friends in L.A. who is a native. I'm born out of state, so you kind of know this city like the back of your hand. And thanks for helping me engineer this show. It's kind of hot in the studio, and I was getting a little panicked, and James came in and helped me get some of the stuff going here on the board.
No problem.
This is the 6 p.m. Friday news. We're going to go into James Brown right now. And I love James Brown.
Not as much as James Brown.
I would dare say none of your callers has ever been there, nor have I. However, I know for a fact that when people are, you know, in violent situations like that, life or death, I know adrenaline...
All across America and around the world. the Spike Lee production, Malcolm X, renewed his life story for a new generation, emblazoning the chiseled features of actors Denzel Washington and Angela Bassett in the minds of millions as the faces of Malcolm X and his beloved wife, Sister Betty Shabazz. The Malcolm X who lived, struggled, was imprisoned, followed by the FBI and other government agencies, whose words were like pepper in the bloody scars of America, became transformed over time into someone that he would barely recognize, a civil rights activist, instead of a nationalist, a freedom fighter, a rebel to white nationalism, and, in his own words, one who fought for human rights. For a time, he was the voice and the most recognized face of the Nation of Islam, and the paper he founded, Muhammad Speaks, was sold from coast to coast, one of the few, rare, published voices of an oppressed people. He set up temples of the emergent organization in a score of cities. He was the dark counterpoint to the love thy neighbor speeches of his closest political competitor, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And indeed, his sparks of righteous indignation and anger made Martin's sweet entreaties that much sweeter. Malcolm's February 21, 1965 assassination in New York's Audubon Ballroom did not spark the same kind of public nor political reaction as did the assassination of Martin some 3 years later. Time, Newsweek, and the New York Times maligned Malcolm in death, with the Times calling him a twisted man. Carl T. Rowan, a black journalist, diplomat, and head of the United States Information Agency, was no better. When African and Asian countries paid him tribute, Rowan was disturbed, saying he could not understand all the fuss about an ex-convict, ex-dope peddler, who became a racial fanatic. But while the black bourgeoisie couldn't understand the meaning of Malcolm's loss, black poor and working class people certainly could. He was one of us, they reasoned, and his loss was our loss. His life inspired a generation of young men and women to form and expand the Black Panther Party, the Republic of New Africa, the All-African People's Socialist Party, and myriad other groups. He brought countless white youth out of the cages of white liberalism and into movements for social justice and liberation. In a recent, somewhat amazing example, that of John Walker Lynn, who joined the Taliban in Afghanistan, his trek into the Third World began in the pages of the autobiography of Malcolm X. It has been generations, yet his voice continues to echo anew. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel.
Why Social Security's fall is near. I've written on this subject several years ago, and I'm not really pleased to be doing it again.
It's a little before 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. You are listening to Kill Radio, LA's most unruly radio on the web. My name is Jaime, and after too long an absence, this is Xenophone.